Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting of House Resources to order. It is about 1:05 on March 14th, and present are Representative Herron, Kawasaki, Gardner, Co-Chair Foggy, Co-Chair Seaton. Remind everybody about their cell phones. And today we will hear HCR 19 first, and then we will go to HB 174. That's extending stage permits. Then we will consider HB 89, extraction of bedload material. And if time permits, we will take up HJR 8, opposing genetically engineered salmon. On Wednesday, we will be looking at House Bill 121. That's loan funds for charters, mariculture, and microloans. And House Bill 106, coastal management program. And we plan to hear a presentation by Glenn Gray about how the program operates from the perspective of the coastal districts, and take public testimony and consider amendments. So is there anything to come before the committee? So we will start with HGR 19. Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the opportunity to speak on this resolution. Of course, in the packet there is my statement, and then there is both pro-ratification arguments and anti-ratification arguments that has been well chronicled around the world. And then behind that is Legislative Research Services, where they break down each whereas and try to explain from an independent point of view what the whereases do, and then of course the resolutions. I'm going to ask staff to come up, and we do have a short slide that a previous committee heard saw from Admiral Colvin, but basically the Law of the Sea Treaty has been around for quite a while, and the U.S. Senate has chosen not to debate it and vote on it. Hopefully they will, but this is a clear message from the legislature by request of Senator Lisa Murkowski. But essentially, the United States is an Arctic nation because of Alaska, and it has, with that, that brings broad and fundamental interest in the Arctic region, where we seek to meet our national security needs, to protect the environment, to responsibly manage and develop our resources, to protect and account for our indigenous communities, to support scientific research, and strengthen international cooperation on a wide range of issues. In my opinion, that's what this resolution says, and the message that I propose that we send back to the United States Senate. And so,
thank you. Before we proceed, I wanted to recognize that we've been joined by Representative Wilson, and also wanted to clarify that we have before us the EDT version B.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's correct.
Okay. We're on 19. Thank you. I also want to recognize that we've been joined by Representative Dick. And would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Rob Earle, staff to Representative Herron. The United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea was entered into force in November 1994. This convention establishes a treaty regime to govern activities on, over, and under the world's oceans. Mr. Chairman, it builds on the four 1958 Law of the Sea conventions and sets forth a framework for future activities in parts of the oceans that are beyond national jurisdiction. The treaty comprises 320 articles and 9 annexes. It's about 200 pages. I have it printed out here if anyone would like to look at it. The convention defines the rights and responsibilities of nations in their use of the world's oceans. As Representative Herron mentioned, this particular resolution, HDR 19, urges U.S. Senate ratification of the treaty. And Senator Lisa Murkowski, in her speech to the legislature on February 24th, requested such a resolution to help her get a ratification vote to the Senate floor. Under the treaty, member nations can claim an exclusive economic zone up to 200 miles from their coast with sovereign rights to explore, develop, and manage the resources within that zone. A claim can extend beyond the 200-mile limit if a connection can be proven that the nation's continental shelf extends beyond 200 miles. It's estimated the area off the coast, north coast of Alaska, is about the size of California. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I could go through these slides really quickly that Representative Gardner has already seen, but these were presented by Admiral Colvin in the last hearing on this resolution. And this first one, I think that first quote from a Chinese admiral is very interesting, that because China has one-fifth of the world's population, they're entitled to one-fifth of the Arctic's international.
And just for clarification, can you identify who the admiral is?
Admiral Colvin, sorry.
And what's his position?
Very much in favor of ratification.
And he's admiral of where? Coast Guard.
Sorry, Navy. Coast Guard admiral. In the Alaska jurisdiction, yeah.
Alaska jurisdiction. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. In the second slide, you can see they're tracking the Chinese in the Arctic. Summer 2009. And also the summer 2010.
Mr. Chairman, on these two slides where it's tracked, that was actually by homegrown, in concert with a homegrown business from this state, the Marine Exchange, helped in these tracking of that Chinese vessel.
Thank you, Representative Herron.
And here on a fourth slide, you can see the remaining white space. Have not been claimed. It's this area here. And then between slides 4 and 5, that's what we could claim. The U.S. could claim that extra area there. And that's exactly where the Chinese have been poking around lately.
And Representative Gardner.
And just to be certain, I understand that with ratification of the treaty, we could extend our claim, as the slides show. But with that, we're limited.
To the Chair, Representative Gardner, that's correct. We cannot even make a claim without first ratifying the treaty.
And thank you. I want to recognize we've been joined by Representative Munoz. Representative Herron, did you have a?
Just on that point, and I appreciate Representative Gardner bringing it up, is under Article 76 of the Convention that a coastal state with a broad continental margin may establish a shelf limit beyond 200 miles. And so we could go to 350 and because of the extension of our continental shelf, there's 350 miles. There's areas of potential out there that are, to some, beyond imagination. And what the slides have shown is the Chinese are exploring from 201 to 440. And so I would say that that it is in our best interest for national security that we have an opportunity to have jurisdiction over the extra 150 miles.
And thank you, Representative Herron. Rob, go ahead and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Wait a minute. We had Representative Feige.
Question on, I assume the Russians have signed on to this treaty?
Yes, sir. All the Arctic nations, through the chair, Representative Feige, have signed on to the treaty besides the United States.
Okay. So why have the Canadians not extended their exclusive economic zone?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, the Canadians have made their claim with the UN, and I don't think it has been approved yet. So I believe they did make a claim extending their zone.
Representative Herron.
Representative Feige, on that slide is that, I'll speak to the Russians' claim, is all the other Arctic nations do not believe that that is a legitimate claim to go that far, yeah, all the way to the international boundary that extends to the North Pole, but they've done it anyway. They signed onto the treaty. They signed on the treaty early on, but it wasn't until 2001 that they made their claims for extended sovereignty. And you only have, when the time you join and to the time you make your extended claims, you only have 10 years. And so it's been 10 years since they've made that claim. And so they're working through the Arctic nations and all the people that are signers of the treaty, they're working through those claims. So if we were to sign on today, we would have 10 years to submit our claims. And what is interesting is the United States, even though they're not a signer of the treaty, they're allowed to make comment on all of these other nations' claims as well.
Okay. Rob, go ahead. Oh, wait a minute. Representative Wilson had a question.
Well, my question, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, what has been the reason that the United States hasn't signed on? They're afraid of something. What is it?
To the Chair, Representative Wilson, some people are concerned about a loss of sovereignty. Whenever the United States joins in any treaty, there's always, you always give up some quote-unquote sovereignty. But the idea is that the benefits greatly outweigh anything you give up. And the reason this hasn't been ratified is because there's certain senators that are against it, that have been holding it up.
So all the countries,
Representative Wilson.
So all the countries that have signed on to it so far, evidently feel that it's worth the chance for the minerals and whatnot that are in the natural resources that are under the ocean.
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, 161 countries have signed on so far. And, yeah, I think they all think it's a good deal, too.
Representative Herring.
Representative Wilson is, of course, there's the pro-ratification arguments and the anti-ratification arguments in the packet. But I understand the sovereignty issue, but since we're not a member of the treaty, we can't make these extended claims. And we really have little to say about any other claims that other countries would make. And interestingly enough, because of the Atlantic coast, the Pacific coast, the Gulf of Mexico, and our Alaska coastlines, we would have the largest EEZ area in the world if we were to sign onto the treaty.
Mr. Chairman, I think we're done with the slides unless there's any more questions related to the slides.
Anyone have questions? Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate the presentation.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, there is a version I for Indigo, a new CS.
Representative Herring, or would you like to move version I?
Mr. Chairman, make a motion to adopt CS for House Joint Resolution 19, version I.
There's objection to discussion. Would you? Is
that on the table?
Mr. Chairman, I'd ask staff to go over the changes.
Okay, and just a moment. I want to wait until make sure that everybody has version I in front of them. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The aforementioned legislative research report precipitated this CS, and we would like to thank Ledge Research. They did a very good job in a very timely fashion. And we kind of asked them to sort of vet all the whereases to make sure they're accurate, and they came up with just a couple changes. And if you see the whereas on page 3, line 14, we just kind of reworded this. It stated that there was a hearing in 1994, when in fact it was pending before the committee in 94, but there's no hearings until 2003. So we just reworded that. And then also somehow the whereas above that on line 12 was dropped in the shuffle, so we added that back in. Those are the only changes, Mr. Chairman.
I'll remove my objection.
Okay, objection has been removed. Any other objections to adopting version I as our working document? And that added on page 3, the whereas starting on line 12, whereas 161 nations have ratified the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, including almost all the world's maritime powers, and then changed the date reference on the same page, page 3, line 16. So without any further objection, the committee has version I before it. See, do we have public testimony? We have Paul Fuse.
Mr. Chairman, this is Dr. Brigham from UAF.
Yes, Dr. Brigham. Let's see. Yeah, while we're working on this here, why don't you go ahead? And would you identify yourself again on the record, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Lawson Brigham, and I'm a distinguished professor of geography and Arctic policy at UAF. I was a Coast Guard officer for 25 years on icebreakers at both ends of the world, and I've also served as the Alaska Office Director of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission in Anchorage. A relevance to the topic, during 2005 to 2009, I was chair and U.S. lead for the Arctic Council's Arctic Marine Shipping Assessment, a large assessment that deals with enhanced marine safety and environmental protection for the Arctic Ocean, including the waters, coastal waters of the U.S. Arctic. A central finding of AMSA was that UNCLOS was the key legal framework from which we viewed all else in our work, governance, Arctic shipping, and all other marine uses. In our review in AMSA, we restated that since the Arctic Ocean is one of Earth's oceans, UNCLOS provides the legal basis for managing the new maritime Arctic. No new treaty or any comprehensive new agreement by the Arctic states or other states is necessary. Importantly, UNCLOS preserves and codifies the principle of freedom of navigation for the Arctic Ocean and the global oceans, a key tenet for U.S. security and economic well-being. UNCLOS provides two important articles, one of which you've heard today. Article 76 allows the coastal states in an orderly process to assert sovereignty on the extended continental shelf beyond 200 miles, the exclusive economic zone out to 350. But another article, Article 234, allows the coastal states the right to adopt and enforce non-discriminatory laws and regulations for the prevention, reduction, and control of marine pollution from vessels in ice-covered waters within the EEZ. Both of these have important implications for Alaska and the United States maritime arc.
Did we lose
knowledge for a global shipping game that dealt with the Arctic and future Panama Canal? One overwhelming outcome was that the U.S. Continued failure to ratify UNCLOS would create substantial risk for the United States in terms of economic development in the Arctic and will threaten the U.S. position as a global leader in maritime issues. In summary, a U.S. ratification of UNCLOS is essential for all future challenges and opportunities in the Arctic Ocean. In my mind, it is at the heart of much of what we in Alaska and the United States will do to protect, develop, manage, and lead in the future maritime Arctic. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you. And do you have your testimony written?
I do in front of me.
Could you send it to you
electronically and will.
That would be very helpful. Thank you. Are there questions of the committee? Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Dr. Brigham. We've heard that the Chinese are operating educational missions up in the Arctic. Could you tell me what the effect of the extension of the economic zone, the U.S. economic zone, would have on those activities?
Well, our sovereignty, of course, extends to fisheries resources and the seabed resources, but doesn't restrict freedom of navigation and transit of those ships and educational opportunities. I guess you mean like something like tourism, but seeing the place and experiencing the Arctic. I think that certainly is all allowable under the UNCLOS.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much, Dr. Brigham, for your testimony. And now we'll come back to Juno here, and Mr. Foose, would you go ahead and identify yourself, who you're representing for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Paul Foose, and I'm chairman of the board of directors of the Marine Exchange of Alaska. We're headquartered here in Juneau, but we're a service that was started by all the major elements of shipping within Alaska, every single aspect of it, as a service organization, and we've been providing vessel tracking services. We'd like to thank Representative Herron for taking a leadership position on this. It may have been a little bit more theoretical for us in the past because we didn't see so much activity in the Arctic. Now it's very, very sure that there's a lot going on up there, and that's what we're finding through our vessel tracking. And I, you know, can understand people's concern about sovereignty, but it just seems to me on balance on this, if we don't do it, we're surrendering our sovereignty. So this is, these are some of the, what did I do here? There we go. So some of the issues of, you know, it's regulatory oversight. Some of the, you know, we would have concerns about not people playing by the same rules that we have to. And I think that there's been a lot of concern about oil and gas development in the Arctic. And there's a lot of people, you know, discussing what's the best way to regulate that. It doesn't make a lot of sense that if we could not do it, if we could extend and say that people are going to operate by the same rules, it's the same body of water, we're likely to have the same impacts if people aren't operating in a safe way. These are the receiving stations that we've set up around the state of Alaska. We've got about 80 of them. And by International Maritime Organization law, vessels are required to have a transponder on board over a certain size and put that signal out, but there was nobody there to receive the signal. This is like what you'd say is a maritime version of Capstone, if you're aware of what happens on the aviation side. These are the sites we put up in the Arctic since there's been a lot more, you know, concern about what's happening in the Arctic. We put up quite a few more sites up there. We're on city government buildings, schools, we've got on some GCI facilities, wherever we can get electricity and a hookup to the internet, we can provide this tracking. Now, these are just color codes on the site, it's hard to read, but these are the different types of vessels that are operating there. And this is from May to October in 2010. You can see there's a lot going on in the Arctic, both on the Russian side and on our side. These are historical tracks of what's occurred up there.
Representative Feige.
Yes, sir.
Just a technical question. What's the range on those transponders? How far off our coastline can we receive a signal?
Representative Feige, through the chair, it depends upon the location and how much radio noise there is in the area. Mm-hmm. If we've got a clean site, we're seeing out beyond 200 miles. The longest we're seeing is 350 miles. Mm-hmm. However, in some areas where we had to locate, like let's say collocate with GCI, where they had some strong radio antennas there, we were seeing as little as 20 miles. So we're looking at, you know, looking at better locations that have much less radio frequency interference. Okay. But this shows that we can, another Alaskan has said, is we actually can see into Russia from here. And this is a track of a vessel that's going, you know, through the Russian waters. We see all the way over to the Russian coastline. Is there another question?
I don't see any. Go ahead.
Okay. So this is the icebreaker. This is a picture of it, the Sway Long. We picked them up and on their track. That's what it looked like. It's a very large icebreaker. They're building one now that's about half again this big. It'll be perhaps one of the largest icebreakers in the world, intending to operate up in the Arctic and having just free reign to do so because we don't have any jurisdiction and we've not ratified the Law of the Sea Treaty. Now here's another bulk vessel. This is a this is delivering fuel to the coast of Russia, and of course, anytime you've got tankers carrying fuel, that's going to be a concern. Again, from the Gamble site, we're seeing vessels operating in the Russian zone. This tanker is bound for Canadian oil field development. Again, it's just a chart of it. And this is the offshore area open to other nations on the shelf up there. When you get beyond the shelf, it gets so deep, it's probably not very rational for anybody to do it unless they were going to do very deep sea mining of nodules or something like that. And under the Law of the Sea Treaty, that is completely regulated by the Law of the Sea, the tribunal under that. Okay. But for the rest, it would establish rights for us as a coastal state.
And Representative Gardner has a question.
Thank you. Go back one slide. And you said that this was a Russian tanker that was going to Canada for...
It's not a Russian tanker. It's just bound for Toyuktuk, which is a Canadian, one of their offshore oil field developments. It's a tanker delivering fuel to them.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what the, if I could see a little bit closer in the top right of that, when we track these vessels, it gives us what the vessel is, what the country of origin is, what the cargo type that they're carrying, what the depth of the vessel is, the beam, all, you know, quite a few operational aspects. For some of them, we can get right down to what the rudder angle is on the ship if it's a AIS type A, the most advanced type of transponder on the vessel.
Thank you.
So I think that's about it. I just want to say we do have the technical capability of knowing what's going on in the Arctic domain awareness, and we're seeing a lot of activity up there. So this isn't just a theoretical question anymore. It's very real, and you know, as policymakers, I think you just have to weigh the costs or the benefits of it. But to me, it just seems like we'd be surrendering our sovereignty rather than claiming it by failing to ratify the Law of the Sea Treaty.
Thank you, Mr. Fuz. Any further questions? Thank you for your test. Oh, Ms. Peggy Wilson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a really weird thought, but, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained. So I'm thinking, is it anywhere possible somehow that the state of Alaska could make some kind of a commitment and not the whole United States?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, no. The treaties of the United States are controlled exclusively by the United States Senate.
Okay.
If we could build an island out there, then we could have some extension. All it takes is money. All it takes is money, that's right. Now we have Kathy Wasserman.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome.
My name is Kathy Wasserman. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League. The Alaska Municipal League, back in November, passed a resolution, which I believe you're just getting handed out now, in support of the United States government ratifying the Law of the Sea. And since then, much like many of your staffers, when I had to write the resolution, that caused me to actually have to look up the Law of the Sea and find out what it was all about. And it was actually very interesting. I noticed that probably the last 7 or 8 presidents of the United States have been in favor of the ratification of the Law of the Sea, as have most of the State Department employees. Hillary Clinton pushed big for it. All of the presidents, including Bush, Clinton, on both sides of the aisle. But there seems to be a holdout in the Senate by a few members who believe that they would be giving up our economical sovereignty. We believe at the AML, after researching it, that the most important aspect of the Law of the Sea is the ability to claim the seabed mineral resources in the continental shelf, even beyond the 200-mile exclusive economic zone. The limit of Alaska's area in the Alaska's Arctic is not yet known. It has technically been defined in the convention, but hydrographic surveys have not determined the full extent of the potential area along the Chukchi Cap. But it's believed to be very extensive and is thought to maybe reach as far as the North Pole itself. I was at the same meeting as Representative Herron, and Representative, you might correct me if I'm wrong here, but I believe they said there were 7 or 8 countries that were not even bordering the Arctic that were trying to make claims on Arctic mineral resources. And here we, as the United States, sit there twiddling our thumbs while all of this is happening around us, and it seems very, very irresponsible. Just last week, I was in D.C. for a week, and for the record, I was not at the Energy Committee meetings. And while there, I happened to have a meeting with the Undersecretary of the Department of Natural Resources, and I was meeting with him with some other Western states, and the big main issue tended to gravitate towards the black-footed ferret. And not to be unfair to the black-footed ferret, I asked him if he was aware of all the mineral resources that were up in the Arctic, and he looked at me sort of blank and said, well, that I don't think that's from our department. Well, as the Department of Natural Resources within the U.S. government, I think it should be in his department, and the United States seems to be not tied in as well as they should be to this issue. We have sent our resolution to our delegation, and I know that both Senators Murkowski and Begich are working on this and have done quite a bit of research. The lack of ratification of the Law of the Sea on the part of the United States would just simply retain the status quo, but we already abide by many of the laws of the Convention of the Sea, navigation laws and others. So we abide by many of the laws, but we don't have a voice. And so I think I would hope that you would support this resolution and that we can help change this.
Are there questions for Ms. Wasserman? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify on HJR 19? Is there anyone else online to testify? Seeing none, I'll close public testimony. We have before us version I, committee discussion. Representative Dick.
I do have a question. I'd like to know who the senators are that are, opposing this and what their arguments are.
Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, to Representative Dick. There are essentially a handful. Imhoff is the only one that comes to mind. But I think that if you, it's been talked about in testimony, is that it really is what they believe is negatively impacting our sovereignty. And I would, it's, I guess that's what the, how they feel, that we would be giving up sovereignty to a tribunal. Whereas, as you heard, the testimony is we're not giving up. Most people believe that we would be just surrendering it. So I think, in essence, it's a handful. 4 to 5 senators are blocking it because of those committee assignments.
And, Representative Dick, when we were, those of us that were at the Energy Council, we had a presentation by Senator Wicker, I think that's Louisiana, could be the Mississippi, but it was one of the southern states. And he, I asked him the question at the end of his presentation about the minerals, oil and gas resources, and his response was that we should, have the Secretary of State do all due diligence and efforts to gain control of those, but then when it was on follow-up that it was the Laws of the Sea Convention, he was much more reticent because there are some interest groups that feel that there is some conflict with sovereignty. Every time, if we sign the convention against landmines, we're agreeing to an international protocol to do something. Every time we sign a treaty, it's an international protocol, and some people feel that we should not be involved in any treaty or international protocol. So it's the information that was provided to us. There were 4 initial reasons that the Heritage Foundation had opposed it, going back to the Ronald Reagan era, and those things had been corrected and changed, and so there was only one outstanding issue that they identified, and that was this idea that signing a treaty, you give up some of your sovereignty because you're agreeing to a process that includes more people than yourself. And so that was the issue that was identified at that meeting. And that's the only issue that I've been told there. Yes, Representative Dick.
Yeah, follow up. Well, you know, I'm concerned about our sovereignty as a nation. I think we've made some major compromises in the past. And so I'm just trying to get informed here. One thing I noticed is 90 billion barrels of oil. My thought is we can't even get the oil that's on our own land. Well, why is this a incentive? We can't even, I don't see how that's meaningful. As if we could access 90 billion barrels, we can't even get at our own oil. So that isn't a carrot for me. That doesn't have any meaning for me. Okay, I guess I don't mean to be a wet blanket, but until I knew more about details on what we would be giving up in sovereignty, I'd have to hold out on this one.
You know, and everybody has their vote and their considerations, and mm-hmm. and that's perfect. That's what we're having as committee discussion. You know, I would point out that the Coast Guard commander for all of Alaska came to the last committee and testified that the Coast Guard does not see, and neither does the Secretary of the Navy or any of the military that have all supported this. And he had official permission to come and testify, and we saw the presentation here today of what he had. So I just I think that statement is in the record here, too. Representative Herring.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, too, Representative Dick. Is this whereas, it just spells out the potential, is that if we do not sign the law of the treaty, is then we're surrendering this to other nations, which we would legitimately have claim to once we sign the treaty. We could go that extra 150 miles, and being on the extension of our outer continental shelf, we have 10 years to do it. We would have first place. We have first rights to lay into that claim. If we choose not to, and someone comes in and who makes a claim to those resources, essentially we're in second position.
Are there further committee discussion? The will of the committee?
Mr. Chair, I'd be very happy to move if you're ready to move. HJR 19 version I with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Are there objections? Seeing no objections, HJR 19 version I will move from the committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Zero fiscal note, and we'll send the paperwork around to be signed. And we'll take a brief at ease while we're waiting for that to be signed. We're back in order, and we have now before us House Bill 174 by Representative Feige. Representative Feige, would you like to introduce the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. 174 is a bill that seeks to essentially limit a tactic that has been utilized to try to discourage development within the state. As we all know, Alaska has a permitting system which various departments and resource managers use to oversee the myriad of projects that are undertaken throughout the states. It is a one of the most comprehensive permitting systems in the world, and the best analogy I come up to it is it's kind of like a pilot's checklist, where instead of being items to fly the airplane and to operate the airplane in a safe and proper manner, the permitting system is used as a checklist to make sure that all the municipal, state, and federal laws that pertain to activities are followed. Over the years, there have been many cases where development projects were, a lawsuit was undertaken, and as a result of the lawsuit, a judge issued a stay or an injunction against the activity on the project, effectively putting a hold on that project. What this bill intends to do is to allow for any permits that have already been issued for that activity, it allows those permits to basically be placed on hold. Most permits have a time period associated with them, anywhere from 3 to 5 years. And the tactic that has been used is to put a stay on the permit and then have that force that company to continue to update the permit even while it can't engage in the activity that they're trying to accomplish. In the process of sort of staffing this piece of legislation around through the applicable departments, DNR, DEC, Fish and Game, and DOT, we raised a number of issues with them that we're going to take their comments. We've received some comments that are going to require some minor tweaks to this, perhaps some major tweaks when we're all done. But all the departments have indicated that it's something they would like to see. It's just a matter of ironing out the details. So at this time, we have not requested public testimony. We have not requested a testimony directly on the part of the departments, although we do have several of them online if there are any questions. So this is a bill that we'll introduce now, but it's going to take a while before it gets to its final form.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I think my question is kind of to the sponsors. You know, we've heard a lot about permitting problems and delays at the federal level, and I'm thinking particularly of NPRA and the OCS air quality permit for Shell. How much of a problem is it on the state level as compared to the federal level? Because, when I think of permitting problems, it's mostly at the federal level. So, and then obviously what we're doing here, we can't impact federal permits. So that's my first question. And then secondly, if there's a lawsuit and a judge or court intervenes and issues a stay, and under the terms of this bill, the timeline is still valid, that doesn't mean that something couldn't be revoked if the lawsuit is successful.
That's correct.
I'm sorry, it could be revoked or could not?
Sure. The permit is up to the permitting agency to grant or not. But if a permit is already granted, this would apply to state-issued permits. It doesn't have jurisdiction over federal permits. But if it's a state-issued permit, it seeks to allow that permit calendar to be extended. In other words, if you're 1 year into a four-year permit when the stay is issued, you would still have 3 years remaining on that permit whenever the stay was lifted.
Okay, thank you. And then I guess
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. And I don't know if it's for you or for one of the people online, how much of a problem it is at the state level for appeals and lawsuits.
Let's see. We do have Wynn Menifee, Division Mining, Land, and Water. Wynn, are you online?
This is Wynn Menifee, and I'm just available to answer questions if you need it.
And did you hear that question?
Sorry, I missed the question.
Representative Gardner, would you like to restate the question?
Sure. In talking about challenges to permits and time delays because of challenges, I think we're all familiar with some big cases that deal with federal permits. How much of a problem is this at the state level?
Well, basically, Representative Chair, I guess the delays, we do occasionally get the situation where people do sue and it does create delay. The one thing that can happen, though, is that depending on the type of authorization we give, the permit or the authorization may or may not be issued at the point of the stay being issued, and it has to do with our process. So if you have a permit, which is a short-term type thing, we could get into a delay like this, but typically what we do is we will, as we get through the end of the stay, we will extend the permit anyway, because we have the right to do that under our authorities. Under a disposal of interest decision, we wouldn't have issued the authorization at the point of appeal, and so the stay, the decision usually says, hey, it's a 25-year authorization. By the time we get to the end of the the court hearings or whatever it is, we would be at a point where we can issue the 25 years from that point on. So we tend to deal with those delays in that manner. But do we have the delays? Yes, we do have delays because of lawsuits and appeals.
Okay. Representative Gardner, follow up.
Thank you. Just one last question. What is the reason for having a time limit on the permit? A 25-year permit seems pretty long. So what's sort of the thinking behind that?
Representative, through the chair, we do actually have limits on all of our authorizations. For instance, permits that are issued under AS 3805-850, they have a limit of 5 years is the maximum we can do, and because they're supposed to be temporary in nature. Long-term disposals of interest, like material sales or leases, they actually can be issued for longer periods of time. The reason for the longer periods of time is usually, I think the reason why the statute was created was because of the financial interest. If somebody's going to go out and get loans or investments to make the project viable, they need to have the control of the state land or the right of interest there in order to ensure that any investment is going to be able to be amortized out and that they can show that they have that site control.
Thank you.
Thank you. And a question, when wait a minute, we had Representative Kawasaki, and then I'll come back to my question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you just testified that that you already do this administratively, and I'm just curious if, one, if there's ever been a point in time where this would have been of value to the department as a permitting agency, and then, two, if you already do it administratively, does it need to be rewritten in statute?
Representative, through the chair, I'm not going to say that it doesn't need to be done or anything like that. I'm just saying that there's actually situations where we do have authorities to be able to adjust. If there are cases, and I think one of them that was brought up was Kensington Mine, where there was issues about this. And it is possible to get into this type of situation where you have an existing authorization where it does get stayed and a deadline comes up. We just had one on the North Slope just not too long ago where we had somebody with a permit that was under appeal and under litigation, and we reached the extension or the deadline, and we extended the authorization to deal with it. Now, if what the statute, in my understanding, does is it creates a surety for the company that it will get an extension versus the department might give you an extension. So that's, I think that's the primary difference, is it locks in, and then it also does send a message to the people that might be suing for the purpose of delay that there will be an extension granted. So that, it has a slightly different purpose.
Follow-up, Representative Kalsok.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So basically the permit on the North Slope, you mentioned that you extended it administratively through regulation.
Representative, through the chair, that would be correct. Under our authorities, under 3805-850, 850. We have that permit was a temporary authorization, but it was going year to year. And what we did is, while we were under the delay, we have the right to redo those terms, and so we just adjusted the terms to keep them. It was the idea was we were trying to lease the parcel, so therefore the stay came under the lease, but the permit was still valid, so therefore the permit we just extended to keep them operating until we could get the decision issued about the lease.
Follow-up, Representative Kalsar.
Actually, this is another question that's sort of along the same lines on permitting. If when you're just discussing land mining and water, for instance, but if you did, I guess, for a project, a large project of any scale, there's going to be permits for fish and game, clean water permits through DEC or through you, other types of permits. How would you currently track that? I guess, and if there were a stay and this guarantee would be year to year, how would you track how many years each of those permits were extended by? I guess, is that something easily done?
Representative, through the chair, the extensions or the stay and how they affect each different authorization would be handled by each authorizing agency that's responsible for that. Like mining land and water would not track the DEC air quality or water quality permits. That would be up to them. And the way that I understand this bill to be written is it puts the responsibility on each authorizing agency to fulfill the mandate. And so it would be up to those agencies to do that extension if it's required by a law. Would one individual track it? If it was a large project, a large mine project or a large oil and gas development project or something like that, if they were using our large projects team under the Office of Project Management and Permitting, in that case, you would have a project manager that would be looking at all that, being able to coordinate that, and they would do so. If it's individual permits and they're not using any of our coordinating services, then each individual entity would, that authorizes is responsible to do that.
Okay.
Yes, thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to ask, who's online?
We have Wynn Menifee, Division. We also have Department of Law, and we have DEC.
Okay, I guess my question is, in the bill, we have given that so that mining, oil and gas, and state transportation plan. Is there anyone else that authorizes permits or anything in our state that would need to be added to this, or is this all that there is?
Representative, through the chair, when you say, are those the only ones that authorize, the location of those different citations in the proposed legislation fall under different statutes that are used by specific agencies. For instance, I'll just pick the oil and gas one. It comes under a location that is dealing with the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. Under an oil and gas development project, Oil and Gas Conservation Commission does provide a authorization for the drilling, but theirs is not the only authorization. There may be gravel authorizations, water, air quality or water quality. There may be a consistency review from Division of Coastal and Oceans Management. So there can be a whole slew of different authorizations that are required from different agencies that don't normally use that area of the statute. So, therefore, is it broader than just those? Yes, it does take into many more agencies than, or at least more agencies than what are listed supposedly under that legislation. And by the fact of the definition of permit that's outlined in this proposed statute, it does cast the broad net of anybody that authorizes or provides any certificate for those operations.
But
Representative Wilson.
So just the fact that the word permit is in there would allow other agencies to do it? From what I see, because each section addresses a different agency, I'm wondering if we should somehow add something else to cover whatever might be happening in the state. Yeah, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Because this is really a great bill, and I really like it, but I'm wondering if we could broaden it a little bit to cover other areas.
And Representative Wilson, Representative Feige has indicated that they're going to work on this for a while, so is that acceptable?
That's fine.
A question that arises is permits, so this would apply to municipalities as well then, if a municipality has given a permit, and this automatically would extend the permits from the municipalities, is that correct?
Representative, the chair, I don't know if you're addressing that to myself or to the bill sponsor.
Well, let me address it to... let me address it to you, I guess. Yeah, sure. And is this Wynn again?
This is Wynn Menifee again.
Okay, thanks.
The way that I read the bill is that the way it would affect the municipalities, and for instance, if something was authorized on the North Slope, there may be an authorization for the North Slope borough, and the borough's authorizations would have to do the automatic extension also according to this.
Okay, thank you. And unless there's a dispute with that reading of it from the Department of Law, we'll just take that right now, and the sponsor can look at that and see whether that is what he intends by the bill. The other question was, this relies on permits. Does that include leases, such as an oil lease? I mean, we get into positions every once in a while where there's a where there's something that goes through, and oil leases have a seven-year term. Is this going to lengthen the term of an oil lease as well, or is this strictly an authorizing permit?
Representative to the chair, this will win. The way that the permit is defined under each of the sections, where it says the permit means a permit certification authorization or approval, and that's a very broad net, and so therefore it requires anything that needs to be obtained from any state agency or any by the state or municipality. So therefore any authorization or certificate that's required. So therefore it includes leases, rights of way, material sales, permits, all of that.
Okay, then let me ask, I think either Ashley Brown or Cameron Leonard with the Department of Law, are you online?
Yes, we're both here.
I'm just wanting to make sure we understand where the reach is. So if someone had an oil and gas lease that was running out, could one of the partners of that lease institute a suit and therefore automatically extend, if a stay was issued, the length of that lease so it wouldn't revert back to the state? And I'm not saying anybody would do this. I'm just trying to figure out the parameters of being a fisherman, and I know what we try to make regulations and statutes, try to read them as in our favor as broadly as we can. So I'm trying to figure out if that could be a reading in these kind of situations as well.
Yes, Representative. This is Cameron Leonard with the Department of Law. That could be a possible interpretation of this. I agree with Mr. Menifee that authorization is a very broad term. Whether that would allow a co-lessee to be eligible or actually entitled to extend a lease without any approval by DNR or the state. That would be a broad reading of this provision, but it's a plausible one.
Okay, and thank you. And the reason we're just putting these things on the table is to make sure that the sponsor can, as he works on this bill, talk about all of those issues. Representative Feige.
There would still have to be a stay by a court or an administrative order to cease work on the project. So it's, I don't think you could just bring a suit. You'd still have to get a stay from a judge, which for an ongoing, which you're talking about, I believe, is sort of artificially extending the term of a lease.
Representative Feige, I'm just trying to look at what other kind of implications we can have if we're talking about oil and gas leases where we issue them for a term to require a plan of development and follow through on that development, mm-hmm. and to make sure that we don't get unintended consequences as we go forward. I'm sure. I'm in favor of the concept of the bill so that if somebody is sued, but an external, whether it's a 501(c) that can be easily organized by anyone as an outside entity to, I just want to make sure we don't get unintended consequences. So that's why I'm bringing up, I'm not at all meaning that somebody has started something here. Representative Munoz.
Thank you. A question for Cameron. Cameron, as I understand it, this applies to state and local permits. Are there any circumstances where this legislation could also apply to federal projects, transportation projects, or other projects within our state?
Yes, Representative Munoz, through the chair, I don't believe so for a couple of reasons. The definition of permit, of course, doesn't reach that broadly, but even if it tried to, we simply wouldn't have jurisdiction under state law to affect the duration of a federal permit.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I would like to know, get some examples at a future date if this bill comes up, of when not having a provision like this in place has adversely impacted a leaseholder or a permittee.
Good. Is there any other committee discussion on the bill, or anybody want to pose any other questions so that the sponsor can work on those questions in the, before the bill comes back before us? Okay, seeing none, we will put this bill aside, and we will now take up we have HB 89, and HB 89 is by myself, so we have we'll pass some information now. We'll take a brief at ease while we're ready to go, and then it'll be presented by my staff. For us, we have before us House Bill 89, and before we start on that, I'd like to offer version B for the committee. That'd be CS for House Bill 89, version B that has been distributed.
I object for discussion purposes.
Okay, thank you. And would you like to explain the differences between the B version and the M version?
Yes. For the record, my name is Louis Flora. I'm staff to Representative Seaton. And the differences between the original M version and the B version are found on line 6, page 1, line 6 of the B version, where we changed approve flood control project to site-specific flood mitigation plan. And the reason that change was made was due to conversations with DNR on the nature of the flood mitigation project, which is generally a federal term implicating the Army Corps of Engineers at a broader broader project. There are statutes under the existing 3805 that deal with federal flood mitigation projects. This is a smaller scale. This would be a smaller scale site-specific project that would be approved by the Commissioner of DNR. And so we modified that language. And also, in conversations with the Department of Transportation, they had some concern that this entire statute could apply to their operations when they're doing gravel removal to protect their infrastructure, and they didn't want to bureaucratize their process. And so we added language beginning on page 1, line 14, last line there, that says, other than a state or federal government or a political subdivision of the state, and that continues to page 2, line 1. And so that was exempting them from this statute. We didn't want to this, as will be explained later, this statute applies to a private entity that's doing the removal, and so we didn't want to implicate the state agencies in that. That was the only other major change. However, there is a conceptual amendment that we have ran out of time to have legal turn it around before the hearing today. I apologize for that. But this would be on page 2, line 8, after the word state. We're going to insert, the commissioner may request the plans for bed load material extraction to be reviewed by a professional engineer specializing in river hydrology. And the intent of putting in that language is to allow the Department of Transportation projects there was some concern expressed by the Department of Transportation that these, if you were having an extraction that was upstream of state-owned infrastructure, a bridge or a roadway, if they, without having it reviewed by a hydrologist, it could get to a situation where they're would adversely impact the state infrastructure. And so that just to, I think in the findings that the commissioner makes, there's a general degree of protection against that, and this just solidifies that protection, that there would be no, it's going to be well studied that the extraction will not impact the any of the state infrastructure. And so just getting into the general...
Wait just a minute. So that was the difference between version B and version M, forgetting the conceptual amendment for a moment that was talked about. But the difference was simply removing the state or federal government from this. And what was removing...
Approved flood control project language.
Oh, and sites the
changing
flood
that
mitigation.
Specific, okay. Yeah. And I believe Mr. Wynn Menefee is online as well, so he can speak to the need for that as
sure.
Well.
Are there further questions about the adopting version B as our working document?
No, I remove my objection.
Thank you. And so we have, is there further objection? Seeing no further objection, we have then before us a committee substitute for House Bill 89, version B. And Mr. Flora.
All right. So generally what this bill would do is allow for the commissioner of DNR to make a finding based on, you'll see on page 1, lines 8 through 13, there's a set of findings that the commissioner would make, and once those findings are complete, he would have the ability to, under a site-specific plan, offer up bedload material under navigable waters to be extracted by a private contractor for approved flood mitigation projects, and so that would and the main problem that we're facing here with any extraction issue is that the state is bound by statute to receive the fair market value and for its bedload material, for all its material sales. And you'll see in the packet I provided you on your desk, there's a listing of a price listing. They assess fair market value statewide, and you'll see the fees for the upfront fees that a extractor has to pay are quite high, and so that inhibits the ability of a extractor to go in and extract the gravel and resell it because of that high upfront fee. And so what we're doing is we're saying they can go in under the site-specific plan, extract it, net out the transportation, extraction, removal costs, and then pay the state no less than 12.5% of profit. And so they would have then the ability to extract and sell it and make money. And so the general intent of the legislation is to alleviate flooding problems, providing a financial incentive for extractors to go in and extract and sell the gravel. I've provided some slides of some flooding issues with bed load. Generally, bed load flooding is that area that's when the gravel comes down in a sustained rain event, and it over time fills the stream, and so you have a lot of breaching of banks and flooding problems, as you'll see in the photos that I like to run through.
So just for clarification, this is Seward, Alaska, and this is the airport, and we actually have a situation in which the Resurrection River has so much gravel that comes down and the flow is low enough that it deposits and builds up and up, so that the river actually is in some parts higher than the airport because it's gotten so much gravel built up over time. But having to pay $3.25 a yard to take the gravel out means that you're paying that up front, so that you can't do a commercial use of that, and so it's been a real problem. And I know in Valdez they've got a similar problem where there's a lot of gravel buildup, and then you can have flooding. And so the purpose of this bill is to let the commissioner in those cases where you have bed load buildup to come in and say the state is getting extra value by mitigating floods that they're going to have emergencies for and have to pay damages and damage the airports and roads and other things, that they can come in and do this alternative sale, that the state is still going to get money. They're going to get 12.5% of the net profit as a minimum. You know, they might negotiate a higher depending on the case, but then that would allow businesses to actually remove this material, save the state money in the long run, and the state would have these gravel sales, whether they're put on barge and taken to Unalakleet where they need gravel, or whether they're used in the local area or what. But it would then allow paying when they receive compensation from the other projects when they sell the gravel. And so then there'll be some other slides that we'll go through quickly here. And these are from Seward, and this is where Resurrection River backs up, and it just the gravel raises up, and then you have these large flood events that start going over in different places. And we can just run through a couple of these. And this is going out the highway. And here you can see the gravel that's been built up in over time alongside the road here. And they're trying to take it out, but you're trying to take it out at a time in which you're in a flood circumstance. And so it's hard to do anything other than pay a lot of money to get equipment in to try and remove it in to keep the bed, which is loaded up before you start. And now it's up underneath the bridge and that kind of thing. So.
Down the road.
Yeah. And this is what happens out up at Salmon Creek up there. You have a problem of just over time, the gravel comes down and builds up and up and up. And so what happens is then you get a storm event, and then it runs to the outside because the bed is actually built up higher than the surrounding territory.
Question?
Yes, Representative Flagg.
Okay, Basically, the commissioner gets to pick the site, correct? It's designed to be preemptive in nature?
That's correct. Under this bill, what would happen is a contractor or someone that has a project that has a bed load, would apply to the commissioner. The commissioner has to make these findings and determine whether that would be beneficial and have enough added value to the state in the flood mitigation that they would do this. Of course, there's nothing in this bill that restricts or expands the ability of the department to let gravel extraction right now. Right now, people can apply to DNR. It's just that you have to pay the $3.50 per cubic yard, and that is enough that, you know, we don't have commercial outfits going and applying for that because it's so much upfront cost that it just doesn't make sense to do a commercial operation. And what this is trying to do is get it so the state isn't having to use state equipment during the flood to try and maintain the channel, but you do that over time in a well-regulated area with the state being a partner, taking a minimum of 12.5% of the profit.
Okay. I'm between this on page 1, lines 8 to 13. Do you intend to have each of those apply, or any one of those conditions apply?
Representative Foggy, these are with an and here, so that, you know, they must do all these things. It's just that currently the below market value, they've got to determine that that's in the best interest of the state, as well as that the removal will avoid offset future costs to the state. Representative Kawasaki.
Are we in discussion right now, Mr. Chair?
We're in presenting the bill, so you can ask the sponsor.
Yeah, just a question, because you know, we want to make sure that we get the best value for our resource. Gravel's a resource. This interest finding is kind of an interesting thing because I've got a bill dealing with that for oil, specifically in the use of oil. How do you get around the Compton case for selling something at less than value when you talk about maximum value?
And Representative Kawasaki, what we've said is that the commissioner can determine that the savings to the state by the flood mitigation and offsetting those costs that the state will incur with anticipated floods if we don't remove that gravel can be considered as part of the value to the state.
Mr. Chairman, is there somebody from Department of Law online for it, or Bullock, or Don Bullock?
I think we do. Let's see. We
have. He's working on our bill, too.
We have Wynn Menifee. We don't have Law. We can call and get Ledge Legal, huh?
Yeah.
Sure. Well, we can. We'll go ahead with this presentation while we're getting them on.
I was just through the chair. I was going to mention there is existing statute in 3805 allowing the department to for flood control projects to provide decreased, you know, to provide 5,000 cubic yards free of charge and then additional yardage at 50 cents. Cubic yard for political subdivisions. So there is existing precedent and statute for that.
Okay, and that was Mr. Flora. And did you have a follow-up? Okay, Representative Dick.
Now, I have a question. Is there anybody locally there that's selling gravel that would be adversely affected by us making it available below fair market value?
Well, Representative Dick, I'm not going to be able to answer that because this could be at several spots across the, the state. So I'm not sure if up by Denali, I know there's an area up there that has problems and flood problems that somebody might apply for this gravel extraction. It may be the exact people that are currently selling gravel are probably the people that are going to apply for this kind of a usage. So, but it's hard to name who across the state and all those things for me. Anyway, let's see. We have Representative Gardner, Representative Heron, and Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I think my response is to Representative Dick's question, similar to yours, but I'd say if somebody's a merchant selling gravel and they get a chance to buy some below market value, it's a good deal for them, too.
He who owns the dump trucks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Representative Heron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess just a comment as well to my colleague is that, you know, I envision this to be sort of, you know, several layers, is the state may have a resource to mitigate a disaster, and then there may be a subsurface owner that sells gravel, i.e. a native corporation. And so in some ways, it's, I think this, as I understand it, this is a narrow application, right, to disasters. You're not trying to compete 365 days out of the year. It's only to mitigate disasters. Is that correct, Mr. Chairman?
Mm-hmm. That's correct. This requires a finding by the commissioner that you have a flood problem from bed loading in these areas, and it fits within the flood plan. Okay. Representative Feige?
Sure. To follow up on Representative Heron and Representative Gardner, it'd be an additional source, but keep in mind to sell gravel. Gravel needs to be, you know, we don't just grab a bunch of rock and throw it in as gravel. It's got to be sized. So there's crushing and sorting equipment that goes along with that. This would essentially be another source of raw gravel that, as I understand it, so you would need to already have the dump trucks, the loaders, the crushers. So as far as it competing against some other, you know, or providing an extra opportunity to compete against an existing business, I really don't see that happening. I think I see it more as a short-term source of inexpensive raw materials for that operator, so it would generally enhance an existing operation to the benefit of the state and mm-hmm. perhaps property owners associated with the removal of the bed load. That's all.
Okay. And here you can see on the Seward Resurrection River as where it has increased the bed load to where during a high water event it just runs out of the river and every place else. And so anyway, I think that's probably enough pictures, but that's what it looks like when you have bed loading. It's gravel that's coming down generally on a fairly continuous basis, and when water is slow, it's deposited in the beds of streams that builds up underneath bridges, and then when you have a larger water event, there's no distance under the bridges and those kind of things, and then you plug up and then everything goes around. So let's see, we have are there any further questions of the sponsor? Yes, Representative Wilson.
Were you going to do anything about that amendment?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. I would like to offer amendment, conceptual amendment number one.
And I object for discussion purposes.
Okay, and conceptual amendment number one, and I'm going to change a couple of words here. Page 2, line 8, after state, we would insert, the commissioner may request the plans for the bed load material extraction to be reviewed by a professional engineer with relevant experience. And the reason for the substitution of those words is I was talking to DOT, and they will testify here, and they suggested that that was a better way of putting this than the specializing in river hydrology. It would, and they were comfortable with that wording. Representative Wilson.
Thank you. I have a question, and in the bill it says the commissioner may offer, subject to a site-specific, if the commissioner or someone in here is going to be, if from some department, is already going to have done some kind of examination of the area. And wouldn't they themselves, if whatever department it was, have already done something like this as part of the information? So what I'm trying to get at is, if one of the departments does it and has, and they have engineers within their department that do these things, and so I'm wondering if they couldn't do that themselves. And so that there wouldn't have to be any charge to a municipality or some area. I don't understand the. I'm worried about adding cost to the project by having that added, and I'm wondering if the department itself couldn't do some of this.
And Representative Wilson, I think we can get the department up, but I think that. You know, the first page and the findings by the commissioner are more general. In the Resurrection River has a bed loading problem. You know, we will allow a certain, we will allow this to take place. But then when somebody applies to do this, they're going to have a plan of development, a plan of extraction. And DOT would like to make sure that that has been reviewed by an engineer that has relevant experience so that you're not digging a big hole right down below their bridge or something, so that we have this engineered. And I don't think that any of the people who would be proposing to use this alternative mechanism would oppose having their development reviewed by an engineer. Their proposal, and it doesn't even require that the commissioner does that. It may be in an area that the commissioner is free in there, is free to say he's confident it's not going to impact infrastructure if it's taken in a certain area, so they might in some circumstances not do that. I mean, if you were out in the middle of a floodplain and you just want to make sure you have a channel and there aren't any bridges or DOT structures or anything within runways within in a mile, they're probably not going to say, I want to have an engineer come in and do that. But if you're in some of these places where we have bridges, we want to make sure that we don't have the commissioner not be able to say, okay, you got to do it this way because it's we don't want to damage our structures. Okay. So that's the purpose.
Who pays for it, though?
That would be offered by the person that is extracting the gravel that has their plan of development, and their plan of development would be reviewed. Okay. And I wouldn't want to say that the departments necessarily have free engineers that have expertise in particular areas. You know, would have that relevant engineering experience, but they can testify. DOT is here, and they will testify. So, if you would like them to come up and testify on that, would you please come up, Mr. Healy?
Good afternoon. Co-Chairman Representative Seaton and Representative Feige and members of the House Resources Committee, my name is Roger Healy, and I am the Chief Engineer with the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. I do have prepared testimony. Would you prefer I go through that first and then answer questions after?
Okay. Yeah.
The Department of Transportation is familiar with the challenges of containing waters and sediments of our rivers adjacent to our transportation infrastructure. Whether it is flooding along the Seward Airport or undermining of highway embankments on the Glen, Haynes Highway, or others, our large braided glacial rivers have a high bedload of sediment, making the river hydrology unstable and difficult to easily predict deposition areas and new flow channels. Our department does not typically undertake upstream or in-stream excavations adjacent to our bridges, highways, and airports, but when we do, as a part of our capital projects to protect new or expanded infrastructure, the in-stream work is designed by registered professional engineers specializing in river hydrology. Because our transportation infrastructure of highways, airports, and bridges represents significant state-owned assets, the department recommends to the committee that any in-stream work adjacent to or upstream from the state's transportation or facility infrastructure authorized through this proposed bill be designed by professional engineers with appropriate experience. Our department would encourage and support coordination between the Department of Natural Resources and our department when removal of bedload material is proposed near our transportation infrastructure. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm here to answer any questions.
And Representative Wilson, you had a question.
And my question was, since you have the engineers, and I do know that DOT sometimes charges quite a bit for some of these things, and since this is supposed to be something that is a savings for the state, I think it would be good that if they had one of their engineers, because if I remember right, during the budget committee process, there were like, And I don't remember for sure, but there was quite a few engineers plus quite a, and I don't know what they call them. I'd say sub-engineers, but they, you know. But anyway, we have them, and so couldn't this be done at no cost to the project so that we could get as much done as we could and save the state as much money as possible?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, our engineers who specialize in this work will undoubtedly be, if the work is adjacent to our, you know, highways, airports, whatever it may be, they will undoubtedly be involved in the process of review. We have them stationed in each region, and when a specific proposal comes up, they will undoubtedly be reviewing the plan. I think what becomes important is that the operator, there is also a liability associated with that excavation, and if there are, you know, associated impacts to that, then that operator under his plan should follow the guidance of a professional engineer. I would say that this would, we would have to reassess what the impact is. It's not, people are working on active projects now, and, you know, to take on that very detailed discussion and analysis of what this specific operator is up to and what his plan is from a design standpoint and not just a review standpoint is sort of two different cost impacts to the department.
Well, we
follow up, Representative Wilson.
The state pays their the state pays for the positions, you know, I mean, in our budget, so they're already paid for, and but I do know that DOT does charge a lot when they use different people in different areas, and I'm just saying that I don't think they should charge for this.
and just as a matter of, you know, question what's going to happen on a fiscal note, I imagine that if we say that we're going to have some of these around the state and they're going to have to put an engineer, then I wouldn't doubt that there's either going to be another position of it going to have to be in there, or I'm just telling you like it is. Or the other thing I'm a little worried about is that as we've been working very hard to constrain the the number of personnel that are in many departments, and we might reach a situation where somebody is wanting to go forward with something, but if the department's required to go through this engineering, it might delay the project, the private development, by a long period of time. And so that's why I think that, you know, if we're looking at this and it's going to be a, you know, at least 12.5% of the profits, but at 12.5% of the profit, I've talked to the gravel operators, and they said that they thought that that was reasonable. You know, they were talking about 10, 12, you know, in that range, and I think 12.5, because we do have kind of that same number in our other mining lands and waters, oil, royalties kind of things, but that was acceptable to them. So.
Follow-up?
Yes, Representative Wilson.
So are you saying that that's covered in the 12.5%?
No, it's Representative Wilson is covered in their plan of development. I'm just saying that in their response to this bill, they thought that this was something that would allow them to do economical projects.
And so they would be the ones, follow up?
Representative Wilson.
So they would, the person that's doing the project is the one that's supposed to pay for this?
That's correct. So they have to design the project, and they would have to have, you know, engineers consulting on the project so that it wasn't going to damage something else. And that's part of their, if they want to propose a project.
Okay, but what I'm saying is somebody has to oversee this. Somebody from the state has to oversee this anyway. And so somebody from the state is going to have to look at their project, and probably one of these professional engineers are going to have to look at the project anyway to see if it's adequate with what they're going to do. So why not have them be the ones that do it so that whatever.
Good point.
No, I like it.
No, I mean, I understand that, but there is a difference between designing a project from an engineering standpoint and reviewing another engineer's design. I mean, there's a lot of difference in what goes forward. That's all I'm saying. So, but, let's see, Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In looking at the slides and hearing the presentation of the bill, it sort of seems like this happens on an emergency basis when the flood is there. But as the gravel builds up, surely we can sort of see it happening, know that time is coming, and could preemptively arrange to have the gravel sold and removed before it's actually a crisis. And I think the language that you have here in on page one kind of would allow for that. It doesn't have to be an emergency basis. And if that's the case, I wonder about how the costs compare. I mean, if it's not an emergency and people can come in the course of their normal affairs to come and get some gravel, then how would the cost proposal, the sale price, if you will, in your bill compared to what they normally get somewhere else? I mean, why would we need to do that?
Representative Gardner, this is not thought of as an emergency situation. What this is thought of as when you have an area that has this bed loading that takes place, you know you're going to have a flood. And you know at $3.50 a cubic yard, nobody is going to come in. And this is, you know, in the riverbeds, it's suboptimal gravel. I mean, it doesn't have the fines with it and those kind of things. So you're not going to have people come in and do this and pay $3.50 or $3.25, $5 in Cordova a yard to remove and maintain the stream bed depth so that you're not going to have a flood. So and we don't. That's why we have all the floods. And so the purpose of this is to make it so that we can have a commercial operation.
Got it.
And,
thank you.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Chair Seaton. I appreciate the bill, and I appreciate the work that you've done on it. It seems to make a lot of sense to me. For Roger, thank you for coming today. It's nice to see you. It's a little bit of deja vu. You know, we used to deal with gravel issues on the local level quite extensively, and it's interesting that we're talking about it here today. But anyway, I was curious, would the DOT compete for this gravel as well? I mean, as a major consumer of gravel, or do you have adequate sources for gravel for your projects?
Representative Munoz, through the chair. Our gravel needs typically depend upon the specific requirements of a project, and whether or not it depends. If we're looking for a paving project, say, there are specific either hardness requirements or fracture requirements within our aggregate mix that may drive us away from this type of source. I mean, it's not to say we wouldn't use it, but we would look around in a particular area and see whether or not, you know, that this site or another site meets that need of either the sub-base material or base course or pavement. So it would really depend of whether or not we would use it or not, and I would generally say probably not.
Thank you. Okay, and we have Don Bullock online, and before we go further, Representative Wilson, do you still object to the conceptual amendment number one? When we adopt it, you can adopt. You can offer another amendment later.
Yeah, I'll remove my objection.
Thank you. Are there further objections? So we've adopted conceptual amendment number one. We have Don Bullock. Are you online?
Hello, this is Don Bullock.
Thank you for being online. We have Representative Kawasaki had a question on HB 89.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Don, for being here. I see your name on the work draft. And as you know, we've been working on a sort of a similar bill dealing with selling royalty oil at below the market, fair market value. We've had complications, of course, dealing with a Compton case in selling for less than the fair market value. Can you address that in terms of this bill?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Kawasaki. Just turning to the Constitution for a moment, the statement of policy in Article 8, Section 1, it says it's at the policy of the state to encourage the settlement of its land and the development of its resources by making them available for maximum use consistent with the public interest. In this particular bill, we're dealing with a unique situation that has to do with the flood mitigation plan. And under the plan, that's sometimes the case that gravel has to be removed. So there's a benefit to the state of offering the gravel for sale at this, what I believe is a reduced price, to encourage somebody to come in and take the gravel away. So rather than just merely having to pay somebody to take the gravel away to improve the flooding area and to prevent flooding, that both sides benefit. The state benefit from not having to pay to get it removed, and the person that buys the gravel benefits from getting the gravel at a lower price.
Thank you, Don. We do have one person online from Seward, Philip Oates, for testimony. Philip, are you there?
Mr. Co-Chairman, I am here, and for the record, my name is Philip Oates, and I'm prepared to offer my testimony in support of the committee's substitute of HB 89.
Thank you, Philip. Would you go ahead?
Yes, thank you. To show our full support of this initiative, we are enacting a similar resolution in the city of Seward for gravel that is owned by the city. In fact, we're going to propose a resolution to the city council where we'll take essentially the same approach as you see in this legislation, but we intend to do it for a bit a cheaper price than the percentage outlined in HB 89. But however, I would like to thank Representative Seaton, Co-Chairman Seaton, for coming to Seward a number of occasions to examine our problems and help understand a solution. We've also had comprehensive meetings at the borough level with the Department of Natural Resources to address this issue. And the reason this is important is gravel is uneconomic unless it's in, produced in large quantities, and then the cost of transporting the material often makes it uneconomic for commercial purposes. And when you add the state charge for removing gravel in navigable streams, it, it makes it an approach that is just not possible economically. And I think the issue revolves around the state receiving value for its resources. And in my mind, this bill adequately and fully compensates the state in two areas. One, it gives the state a profit that's somewhat akin to the way the state profits from selling some of its other resources other than gravel. But equally important, it provides protection to flooding from the citizens of the state, and it also prevents the state from coming in and assisting with the catastrophes that, that come from flooding. So again, I think the state does receive full value, and this allows communities or boroughs to have a contractor come in and remove the gravel at no cost to the community or the borough, allows the contractor to make a small profit, and it gives advantages to the state, both in profits and also in protection of flood measures, flood protection. I think it's very important that it be validated, as you've discussed in your committee, through appropriate engineering. It also should be validated, as the bill appropriately provides, for it to be for flood mitigation purposes. And I think when those requirements are met, then I think it's a win-win for all concerned. And thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Wilson.
Not for him.
Okay. Thank you, Philip. Appreciated your testimony very much. And is there anyone else online to testify? Anyone else in the audience? Seeing none, we will put this bill...
I have a question.
Oh, you have a question. Okay. We will take a question from Representative Wilson.
Okay. On page 2, line 12, it defines what bed load materials are, and it says gravel, rock, and other materials located below the plane of the ordinary high ground, blah, blah. Okay. So this would mean sand or sediment or anything, right?
That's correct.
Okay. That's all.
Okay. Representative...
I know we're clipping time here, but I did have a question dealing specifically with that. Mr. Chairman, I sort of thought that the bill was dealing with sediment that's left over after a flood, so it would be gravel, displaced gravel. It's not.
No, no, this is material that comes down, washes down generally over time when you don't have a flood, and then it is deposited in and builds up the bed. It's called bed loading, so the bed gets higher and higher because there's not enough volume of water to wash it down. And so then what happens is when you get a higher water event, there's no stream bed left. And so what happens is it just all goes out, and then that's where you have a flood from this bed loading material.
Okay.
Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm thinking about in the Toke area where they have the rivers, and I can't remember the names of them. I'm thinking maybe Big Bear and Little Bear. I'm not sure if that's the right names or not. But you see the braiding in the rivers, but it looks, you know, when you're looking at it, it looks like mostly sand, but I don't know if it's probably glacier runoff or whatever. But would this work in some area like that if downstream, because that's just almost level with the land. And so... are you thinking of just little areas or big areas like that?
It would be in an area, Representative Wilson, where the commissioner has made these findings that there is a flood flood mitigation problem and a plan, and they're trying to maintain a channel so it doesn't flow out into and have cause damage. So these conditions have to be there for this bill to exist. There's nothing that stops someone from going in and doing it now. So let's put this aside and take just a couple. We got a couple minutes. Representative Kawasaki, we have HJR 8. Would you like to take just a couple minutes and introduce that so that we can take it up at a further time and people will know that what we have before us?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for the ability to speak to the committee today. I just wanted to introduce House Joint Resolution 8. It did pass a special committee in fisheries earlier. Basically, what House Joint Resolution 8 is, it's a statement to the Food and Drug Administration and to Congress that says that we want to urge the Food and Drug Administration to deny the application that currently sits before it to sell genetically engineered salmon. There's a proposal from one specific company. It's a hybrid Atlantic salmon, and it could be the first genetically engineered animal for human consumption within the United States. We don't think that there's been enough due diligence at the Food and Drug Administration, and it really sets up a risky precedent for these genetically modified salmon. As we know, we've fin fish that have been farmed in British Columbia have traveled as far up as our own waters. We don't really know what happens when it comes to this particular salmon that is a cross between an Atlantic salmon with the growth genes of a king salmon and an antifreeze gene of an eel. It's frankenfish, and there's some science that needs to be done. We don't think that there's enough due diligence done to approve this as food for consumption. There's one amendment that was sponsored by Representative Herron. We didn't get to it in the previous committee, and so we've got it here today, and we can introduce it at a future time.
Okay, thank you, and we'll distribute that amendment to the committee so that they can look at it between now and now in the next meeting. And are there any questions in 30 seconds left for Representative Kawasaki? Seeing none, appreciate the committee's indulgence in getting this. Have a quick hearing at the end here, and we will see everybody on Wednesday. Again, we will be looking at House Bill 121 and House Bill 106, and we will be adjourned at 3:01.